This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station. The Health News Digest on the bigger picture. BFM 89.9.
Hello and welcome to the show. It's Health News Digest with me, Tina Carmelia, and in the studio are Tisha Eek and Juliet Jacobs. Again, welcome back, ladies.
Good afternoon.
This week, our theme is what lurks in the dark and what we have lined up for the hour.
Yes, we have a story about moving on from what happened with Larry Nassar and the U.S. gymnastics team. Well, he was the team doctor who has been found to have molested a lot of the gymnastics team members. So we're going to look at how to talk to kids about who can touch them, where and when.
We're also going to talk about bedwetting and bladder conditions, and also how students should not be refused the right to use the toilet during class.
But before that, we're going to talk about something I think Sherwick and I are very familiar with, sleepless child worn-out parents. So apparently, sleepless children can reduce their parents' income by 11%. I think that explains a lot about us, doesn't it, Sherwick?
And to lead us into that story is The Kinks Just Can't Go to Sleep, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon and welcome back to the show. It's Health News Digest. I'm Tina Camilla, in the studio with me, Tisha Eek and Juliet Jacobs. Our theme this week is what lurks in the dark. We're going to go with the first story about sleepless children and worn-out parents. According to a study from the London School of Economics, sleepless children can reduce parents' income by 11%.
So this was an interesting study, a really great cohort if you look at it. The Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children actually followed 14,000 families in the UK. Okay, from birth right up to the age of 25, that's the children's age. So they measured the child's quality of sleep first, and that looked at whether the child wakes up at night, what time they go to sleep, their naps, their sleep routines, and environmental triggers of sleep quality. Then they correlated that to whether parents got sufficient sleep. So objective measures of the amount of sleep, as well as whether parents felt they got enough sleep. Answer is no, never. And then the economic indicators were the parents' employment details. So what it found was that babies and children who wake up frequently at night can significantly decrease parental income, the number of hours that parents work, and even labor force participation. Conversely, just an hour more sleep per night for mum tends to boost income by up to 11%. And Juliet, you'd be interested to know, fathers were, of course, somewhat less affected than mothers by the sleeping habits of their offspring.
What a surprise. Sorry.
We all know about the partner who's snoring next to you while the baby's crying.
Crying, doing somersaults in the bed.
Yes.
Yes, that's some...
There was a strong link between the number of times a child wakes up at night and the parents' income trajectory over time.
This is a very depressing story, guys. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks for bringing me part of this.
Yes.
Well, I have you both on the show because you're both mothers of really, really young kids.
I suspect this is something that everyone knew, and this is like the first study to actually prove it. I don't know. You ask any parent, right? We all give each other that familiar nod of... Mm. Yeah, man. And I suppose, you know, the follow-on effect from that is you don't, maybe you don't perform as well at work, or, you know, you miss out on opportunities, you can't travel, for example. Yeah. And so you're seen as the one who can't quite commit to work as much as, let's just say...
Me.
Someone who's, you know, doesn't have kids yet. It's not anybody's fault. It's just the way it is, like you chose to have kids.
Is it really common that kids just cannot fall asleep or stay asleep?
Well, yes, it is. And when I was expecting and started looking at parenting books, the number of books about sleep training, and I think it is relatively modern phenomenon, though. I'm pretty sure our parents' era didn't have this kind of concerns. I must admit that I was a bit of a fascist when it came to training.
Words.
Yes, yeah, I was. When it came to training my son, so fortunately he slept well quite early on.
I want to come back to when you were saying that this is a modern parenting thing. Does that mean that our parents or parents' parents did not have kids who couldn't sleep, or they just didn't care about the kids not sleeping?
I don't know. But anyway, you think about the older generations, and they had, you know, four or five or more children, right?
Yeah, how do they cope?
Exactly.
And because, especially when the age is so...
So close.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't have the luxury of each child to his own room.
Correct.
I don't know. Maybe they just... If you're crying, well... Mom and dad busy with something else anyway.
It's probably also a single income household, so you have the mom sacrificing her sleep to manage the seven kids.
And it's possible also the family structure before was that grandparents maybe were living.
True.
So, you know, there was other help in terms of... there was like a whole village lab, basically, right?
Right.
Looking after the children as well. So, and the other thing I imagine would be that children maybe led more active lifestyles before. I'm just guessing here. These are things I'm throwing out. There was less screen time, you know, those sorts of things, I'm guessing, would have played a role as well.
Mm. We spoke to Dr. Rajini Savanandan, consultant developmental pediatrician, about when kids should start having... longer sleep hours without any disruption.
Mm.
Children under the age of one, they may wake up in the middle of the night for feeds. And if they do wake up and cry for a feed, yes, you do give it to them. But once they're on three meals a day, they're taking enough food, they shouldn't be waking up for milk in the middle of the night unless you've been habitually feeding them. And when I talk about habitual feeding, these are parents who, when the child whimpers or grunts in their sleep, they shove a bottle in the child's mouth. So that child's body is used to having that milk in the middle of the night. So avoid that in infancy. Feed on demand when your child cries. Children who co-sleep tend to have more sleep issues. So co-sleeping beyond the age of 6 months sometimes affects sleep in children. So quite often we encourage that if parents want the kids to be in the same bedroom, that they get their child a bed or a cot next to their bed, but not sleeping right next to them. Above the age of one, even if you're breastfeeding, if possible, try and put your child in their own sleeping bed or cot. The next thing is ensuring you have a bedtime routine. So we often say at least an hour or two before, so 2 hours before your child falls asleep, there should be no screen time because the light rays from LED screens does affect production of melatonin, which is a sleep hormone. Try and do a lot of calming activities. So not jumping around with the child, but maybe reading a story, singing calmer songs, and dim your lights and, you know, it's bedtime. The children who've been trained to fall asleep themselves tend to have less disrupted sleep. The children who need you to put them to sleep, need you to calm them down when they've woken up in the night, those are the children who have sleep issues. So train your kids from a young age to put themselves to sleep and you'll have less sleep disruptions.
I know there's no visuals on this, but as we were hearing Dr. Rajini explain everything, there were
the
eye rolling and snickering and
clutching at the heart. Okay, tell me. What were all those reactions about?
Well, what Dr. Rajani said about teaching kids to soothe themselves to sleep, that was an issue for me and my son early on. And I suppose with all babies, you know, because they're used to the mother's womb. And then after that, they're used to being carried and cuddled. So my son, when he had issues, we did try the pacifier, I'll admit. And the thing was that he never wanted it. He just shoved it out, pulled it out. And he eventually started sucking on his own fingers. A lot of people in the family then started saying, oh, he's going to grow up to be a thumb sucker. For us, we weren't bothered by it because as long as he's able to soothe himself, we'll deal with weaning him off the fingers later. He's 3 years old, still sucking on his fingers. I'll deal with it at some point when his, you know, fingers start to look a bit funky.
Smell a little funky.
One at a time. One thing at a time.
Exactly,
right?
Yeah. If he can get to sleep on his own, that's fine. So that was my experience with that part of things.
And co-sleeping, Juliet. So I was making faces because obviously I failed at everything that Dr. Rajani said.
Oh, no.
When my daughter was younger, I was excellent. We put her to sleep in the cot and she slept and everybody was happy. She just woke up for her milk. But then there was a period in time where I was looking after her alone. My husband was not around. So I would just put her in bed with me just to kind of ease the whole process. And that was maybe about a year and a half ago. And she's still sleeping in bed with us. Despite the fact that we have a king-size bed, her head must touch me, her legs must touch my husband, so neither of us can sleep properly because we've been pushed off the bed. It's also a thing because both of us are working parents. So let's just say my husband comes home late and I've already started to wind her down. But by the time my husband arrives, she's wound up again, of course. And then
yeah,
they will
because
do...
She's excited.
She's excited to see. Obviously, she hasn't seen him all day. So then starts the whole thing again. She'll do somersaults. She'll be hyper. Mm. She'll be running around. They'll be doing all sorts of crazy things. So she's wound up, you know, finally only going to sleep close to 12, which is insane for a 2.5-year-old child.
Mm. And you wake up at?
I wake up at 5.
Insane for you as well.
Yes. It's because I was not strict with her because, again, I've got the guilty working parent syndrome going along. Mm. Right. So she just says, Mommy, I want to play with you. What's a parent going to do?
Right, yeah.
Especially if you've been away for 10 hours from her.
Do your kids take any naps? Yes, my son still does. And because he's going to daycare, they're very strict with that routine. I know some kids cut out their naps earlier. When my son doesn't have his nap, he becomes very, very strange by about 5 or 6 o'clock.
And same, she has to have a nap as well. But we're trying to limit her naps to just like an hour or 45 minutes so that she will sleep slightly earlier.
Let's hear from the expert, yeah, about naps.
If we talk about children above the age of 2, they often still need maybe one nap a day, but that nap shouldn't be too long. So if they're under 2, it may be 1 or 2 naps that they have, an hour at a time, that's fine. Above 2, maximum nap is probably an hour and a half to 2 hours, but no more than that. And they must ensure that the nap is at least 6 hours before the next sleep. So if you want your child to go to sleep at 8, then they should be awake by 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Above 2, some children actually don't need a nap. They actually stop themselves from napping. Or even if they do, it's a very short nap, which is fine. But it's still important to have downtime where you say to a child, okay, this is a break for you, for me, and maybe close the curtains, dim the lights, no play, everybody's quiet, and a child just takes an hour to be quiet in the room or roll around the bed, but nobody's talking to the child and there's no play. Quite often, a lot of children haven't had enough exercise for the day, and that often causes them to have issues with sleeping. So ensuring that they have at least an hour a day of outdoor play or intense physical play is important.
The only thing I can disagree with is my child has a lot of play and that just makes her even more hyper.
We need to bottle up that energy and sell it. That's where you can get your income.
Yeah, that's true.
Make up for the 11%.
But I do agree that a nap is important because it just gives them that little bit of that boost. Because I understand what you said, Shari. You know, if they don't have that nap, they start to malfunction.
Yeah,
and just become really irritable.
Like one of those, yes, like a robot where circuits are a bit fried.
Yeah.
And like,
Then 1 minute they're laughing, the next minute they're crying and throwing. Oh, it's awful.
But let's come back to sleep training, Shari. You were saying that you're pretty strict about it.
We were
softening your choice of word there. It is a divisive issue. Dr. Rajani was also talking about the main question I was asking her is whether it's too late. Because if you're young,
parent, it's a 2-month-old baby, then you can start making all these right steps, right?
Yes. But then also the baby is not aware and can't fight back or can't rationalize.
Doesn't know their options, that they could co-sleep with you, for example. Right. Right. So here's what Dr. Rajini has to say.
Okay, so you need to do a bit of sleep training, probably. So the first thing is trying to train them to fall asleep themselves the first time they fall asleep. You may need to introduce particular soft toys. You may have some quiet background music or prayers or whatever in the background that calms the child down, then switch off before the child falls asleep. So you need to try different strategies. But there's two schools of thought. You go cold turkey, leave your child to cry themselves to sleep, or you can do the gradual stage of, okay, mommy's sitting by you, but I'm not sleeping in your bed. I'm here. Okay, and I'll be here till when you fall asleep. Next time you would, say after a week, you would sit, say 3 feet away from the bed. Next time it would be just at the door. Next time it would be outside the door. Next time it would be, okay, you go to sleep, I'll come back in 2 minutes, that sort of thing. So you could try that, but you have to be consistent. And you have to be consistent when your child wakes up at night, that you take your child back to their bed. And the same thing happens. So it may be 2 or 3 months of sleepless nights, but if you persevere, most children will get it eventually. And reassuring your child and reinforcing when they have fallen asleep themselves, reinforcing to them, you were really good last night, you know.
So both schools of thought are represented here today. Well, there's no silver bullet to this. I mean, if you guys have any ideas at all, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio. We're going to take a quick nap, I guess, because our moms here probably need them. When we come back, we're going to talk about bedwetting and also how students should not be refused the right to use the toilet during class. BFM 89.9.
The Health News Digest on the Bigger Picture. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the show. It's Health News Digest. I'm Tina Camilla. In the studio with me, Tisha Eek and Julie Jacobs. We're talking about the things that lurk in the dark. We've spoken about sleepless children lurking in the dark.
And sleepless parents as well.
Sleepless parents.
My child does lurk. I must mention that sometimes when we're both trying to sleep, she just lurks around in the corner like a creep. I just had to say that.
That's a beautiful image in my head right now. Now we're going to go to the second story about bedwetting. So bedwetting is also known as nocturnal enuresis. And it usually stops between the ages of 5 and 6. Girls typically stop bedwetting at a much earlier age compared to boys. Mm-hmm. We'll find out why later. We have Dr. George Lee, who's spoken about this topic, I think, 5 years ago on Health and Living. But we're going to bring some of that information back for you guys. And by 10 years old, 95% of children are dry at night. We're still left with the other 5%, probably all boys, who still wet the bed into their teenage years.
Oh.
How about your kids? Are they still bedwetting? Juliet is looking very guilty right now.
Because my child is still wearing diapers.
Yeah, same. So our issue is actually with toilet training, not even going into the bedwetting. Yeah,
right. I haven't quite reached that yet.
Sorry, if you don't mind, how old are your kids?
3.5.
3.5. And yours?
Two and a half.
2.5, sorry, Juliet. 2.5.
And three. So very close in age.
Yeah. Right.
Okay. I have just been researching on this. Kids can start toilet training from the age of 2 onwards. Girls usually earlier than boys again. I think both our kids are slightly developmentally slower in this sense.
Flat out refusing.
Yeah, refusing to use the potty, not being able to do anything on the potty when he's on it. Not really consistently able to identify when he's doing a wee or a poo. Sometimes he tells, sometimes he doesn't. So I know I'm having trouble with, you know, just getting him out of the diapers.
Same.
Okay.
I don't want to add to that. Yeah, same.
So there are some physiological functions that prevent kids from knowing how to control their bladder or their bowel movement. Obviously, they haven't fully developed the physiological functions to control these. But at night, there are hormones that come into play to reduce urine production so that you do not need to pee as frequently as you do during the daytime. And at the same time, if your bladder does fill up, it will also wake you up so that you don't wet your bed in your sleep, but you are able to get up and go to the bathroom to go and relieve yourself. Obviously, these functions will take some time before it truly fully develop in a much older child. Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, has some statistics on the incidence of bed wetting.
It is a very, very common condition. I mean, if you look at all the statistics in a Western country, in an Asian country, you're looking at between 3 to 4% in the lifetime of a child. And then also you are looking at, you know, up to 15 years old, you're still looking at 1% of children are still having these problems. Strange enough, it's four times more common in boys.
With the boys, why?
That's right. I think nobody actually can answer that question. Why is it more in boys? And some people put it down to genetics. Some people just put it down to...
Maybe it's physiological.
Okay, let's get back to the absolute basic first. First of all, bedwetting is a condition that we call nocturnal enuresis. It is a very important definition because nocturnal means it only happens at night. Daytime, this child is normal. Enuresis actually means that it's a physiological void in a socially unacceptable location.
What?
Okay, physiological void, right?
What does that mean?
What does that even mean? Okay, physiological void means that all the machineries are actually functioning in a normal way.
Okay.
So there's no abnormality. The kidneys are normal, the blood is normal, and then the sphincter is normal, and then it's a physiological passing urine. Mm-hmm. But yet in a socially unacceptable location. Because it's in the bed. So how can a child be abnormal at night and normal in the daytime?
Yeah.
You know, so therefore, this is a psychological condition that is not physiological, it's not pathological. It's only pathological because it's socially unacceptable.
So Dr. George thinks it's psychological.
I guess there's no way of... You have to find out the case history, why this child is...
Yeah. I mean, obviously, we're talking about cases where, you know, the child is physiologically... Normal. Doesn't have cerebral palsy or other you know, conditions that make you unable to control.
So we're looking at perhaps whether the child has been going through some sort of issues, anxiety.
Attachment. Do you have attachment issues to your diapers?
Maybe, yes.
Diapers that are too comfortable that they don't want to get out of it.
That's maybe a marketing gimmick right there.
You need rough, like cloth diapers that are just uncomfortable.
But see, when you try that in like my case... Child develop rashes. It's always something.
Right.
Or, well, I've read about, you know, they say to investigate whether perhaps the child may be bullied at school, problems with teachers or friends, or even something going on at home, I suppose. Parents, divorce, separation, that kind of anxiety issues could be causing something there.
I think I had it easy because I had an older sibling, so... I just sit in the potty next to her in the toilet bowl, right? So it's like, yeah. I want to be...
Correct, yes,
right?
Yes,
you have
yes.
this role model that Correct, you want yes. to aspire to be. Yes. So it was easy for me. I remember being really young and being really, like, into it.
Wow. Well done.
I don't remember about my sleeping habits, but I remember about my toilet habits.
I think when you have an older sibling, a lot of routines are learned faster, actually.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But if it is psychological, right, then... I don't know if we are asking the right person because here we have Dr. George Lee, who is a urologist, not a psychologist. Mm-hmm. But we did ask him about when you should consult a doctor and what you can expect from such a visit.
I get parents who probably come to see me and say that Johnny is 4 years old. But, you know, 5 years old is a cutoff. I'm still worried. And then, you know, because the sister was completely dry by 6 months old or something like that. Because the girls, of course, are always, always high flyers. For a second.
Always.
That's right. And then, but good things, you have to wait, you know. for boys, you know, it just takes time because the developments are different. Because I think it's difficult to compare siblings and compare what is norm. So the way I'd say to parents is whatever is considered abnormal is whenever the bedwetting is still occurring after school age. So 5, it's usually the kind of cutoff because at that point, the child needs to adapt to a lot more social skills beyond the family.
Right. When it affects the child's life.
Correct.
Then you need to embark on a management.
That's right. I mean,
technique.
I think labeling is, it's like, you know, is this age group nocturnal enuresis? Is this not? I think labeling, I don't find it particularly helpful. And most parents would accept that around 5 years old and below will probably be considered as the norm with compared to the masses.
So there you have it. I think you can consult your doctor if your child is still wetting the bed by the time they're school age.
I think the embarrassment that it causes to the child would be a huge problem.
Yeah. There's a lot of psychological, things related to your self-esteem.
Correct.
You're missing out on, you know, social activities mm-hmm. because you're afraid that you're going to embarrass yourself in front of your friends.
Being teased by them.
Yeah. And also, again, urologist or psychologist?
Yeah, urologist first to find out if there are physical problems.
Yeah. That's right. So here's what Dr. George Lee would do if a child comes to him with a problem.
What you wanted to ask me is that what do I do with the child when the child come in,
yes.
right? It's first of all, say to the child, it's normal. Because there are many, many, many more people who actually experience similar situation like you, and you will get out of this. Because in a way, I don't particularly want that child to feel small, to feel victimized, to feel like they're diseased, you know, because it is not a disability. So therefore, this is the first thing I will do first.
But I can imagine by the time they come to you, and considering our Asian culture,
that's right,
they're probably, you know, psychologically damaged.
Well, yes, it's my job to change that. Although it might be awfully difficult, but actually it is my job because we don't particularly want many, many 1% of psychological damaged boys, you know, in our society. So therefore, dealing with children, the big picture here is dealing with children takes a lot of patience, takes a lot of injecting a lot of confidence and a lot of sensitivities. And in that sort of things takes time. And you need to actually put aside important time for me, because my nurse will know whenever a child comes to my clinic with such problems, her heart will sink. Because I can have two choices. Number one, I would just say this takes too long. I'm not a psychologist. I don't deal with this. Let's give her a pill or let's give him a pill and let's get out of the way 2-3 times to come back and say it doesn't work and say, sorry, I can't help. I can choose that option.
Of course.
Which is probably what many doctors would do.
Right.
Or alternatively, I will go through the psychology of things. I'm not a psychologist.
No,
you're right.
Not.
You're
no.
not. But the thing is that I try to understand what's happening in this child's life and then also trying to convince the mother or the father, don't give up on him. Because the worst thing that you can do is just to say, my child's abnormal, this is the way it is, I'm so sorry, you know, it's like God is punishing me, you know, for something I've done, is bad karma and that sort of thing, and we accept it that way, and then, you know, ostracize the child. Mm. And then that's a worst case scenario. So you give the child some degree to convince them that they are normal, and then also at the same time, you give the parents hope. So it's working together. It's a three-dimension thing because it's between the child, the doctor, and also the mother. And I think that's the important part.
Right.
I can imagine, actually, Dr. George is talking about dealing with a child with sensitivity. I can actually imagine probably a lot of relatives in the family, even teachers, would be making some very harsh comments to the parents and the kid, like, what's wrong with you? You know, you're so big already. Why can't you control this and that?
Yeah.
So that's something that's probably very lacking in our society.
Which will only add to the problem some more, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, yeah. The anxiety.
Yeah.
That's mm-hmm. right.
Yeah. I mean, peeing is a very normal bodily function.
Absolutely.
Right? So an adult can hold about 16 ounces of urine, that's about 2 cups. Mm-hmm. And a child, an 8-year-old child, by comparison, can typically hold about 10 ounces. So that's how full your bladder can be before you need to relieve yourself. And the urine is basically made up of liquid that we use to filter toxins from the bloodstream in the kidneys. So it's very normal body function. If you don't pee, then you're just not expelling these
toxins,
exactly,
the waste products. Yeah.
Yeah.
Dr. George Lee actually also himself had this issue, by the way. Let's hear it from him.
Okay.
I remember vividly the years when, you know, I was just taking to see some, go to some temples to see whether anything else helped. Because whenever you run out of medicine, desperate parents will do anything.
You went to a medium?
Not quite, but I had to drink all sorts of things in temples.
Oh, potions.
In the potions. And
wow.
Also, we've been to temples, we've been to Bomo, we've been to everywhere.
How old were you?
Well, I say where I was 12. That's quite old, yeah. It was quite old. And then my nurse, Wong, always says that if I were you, I won't tell people things like that.
This is national radio.
Absolutely. Well, I just think that if you conceal it, you feel like this is something that you can't talk about, then it is a taboo. It was part of my childhood. A lot of people have difficult childhood. Some people are bullied. Some people are doing the bullying. Some people are... All these are, you know, part of growing up. And then, unfortunately, mine actually involves a lot of urine. And therefore, I became a urologist.
I love all these little stories.
Bless Dr. Cho.
Yeah. But you can see why he's so compassionate and,
exactly.
and why in his approach he's a lot more compassionate. Mm-hmm. It should not be something that you would be embarrassed to talk about. But on the flip side, there are kids who need to go to the bathroom and are not allowed.
Absolutely, yes. There was a story about teachers refusing students the right to use the toilet. This happened in the UK. And I'm not sure whether this is a routine in all public schools in the UK where you need a toilet pass to go to use the bathroom. And according to this online story anyway, you need to even get a doctor's letter to obtain that toilet pass. So if you need a toilet pass, basically it means that something is sort of wrong with you and that's why you need to use a toilet.
Like you have IBS or something
correct. Right? So that seems to me a very strange principle to even begin with. I remember when I was going to school, we could go to toilet in between periods.
Can you go during your class, during lesson?
I think we would have to, you know, do the whole raise your hand, cikgu. And of course, that depends on the teacher's mood at that point. In fact, my friend who has her kids in primary school told me a story where in that school, a student could not go during the break in between periods because she was rushing to finish her homework. So she asked to go during the lesson itself. The teacher actually slapped her.
My goodness.
Before letting her go.
What?
Yes. So, you know, in the UK, in Malaysia, all these problems with just letting kids go to the toilet.
Yeah, and I was reading a few more stories, some recent one. 2015 in San Diego in the US, a mother filed a lawsuit over restrictive restroom policy. Students who exceeded the allotted 2 passes a day were not allowed to use the restroom for the rest of the day. 2015 in Australia, Herald Sun reported that a primary school punishes children for taking toilet breaks during class time with detention. So you have to stay even longer in school where you're not allowed to go to the bathroom.
So I can't imagine some deviant little kids. I can't imagine them, you know, taking advantage and hanging out. But surely you'll know who's who and, you know, as a teacher who's been teaching them for like a year or whatever it is, right? Mm-hmm. And you'd be able to assess and allow children to go and pee and, you know, have certain time frames that you need to come back by, I suppose, instead of just like a blanket ban of, no, you can't use the restroom.
Yeah, absolutely, well, if they attended our government schools, nobody wants to hang out in the toilets.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's nasty.
It's nasty.
Nasty. No, it smells and it's...
And I remember if you were sort of loitering even in the corridors or trying to sneak around the school... there were always teachers around to sort of catch you out and say, hey, you know, go back to class now.
Yeah, what are you doing?
And yes, exactly. Yeah. Which is as it should be. You know, after you use the toilet, then back to class you go.
I remember when I was in, I think it was standard one or something like that, my classmate wanted to go to use the toilet and the teacher refused to let her and the poor thing wet herself in class.
And then that becomes another issue, right? Where she'll be teased, bullied, and then she'll probably go on to be a bit wetter.
Right. So.
And by the way, the right to a toilet is a basic human right under the right to sanitation. This is recognized by the UN. So if you don't allow your students to go and relieve themselves, then you're
violating human rights.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm just thinking, can you imagine if they enforce something like that at our office? The amount of water you and I drink alone, Tina. Right. And you too, Sherry.
We'll be wearing diapers.
Yeah.
So what, yes, that's another point, actually. As adults, I'm sure teachers are freely using the toilets whenever. How can you impose a ruling like that on children who have smaller bladders, as you've mentioned, Tina, who probably have a lot more health issues if they're holding their urine in?
Exactly. Some of the issues that can come up if you are holding your urine include weakened bladder muscles and thus incontinence, as you were mentioning just now, Shaik, enlarged prostate, kidney disorders, and of course, a higher chance of bladder infection. Mm. So I think it's better to just relieve yourself.
Yeah.
Don't hold it in.
So if any kids are listening to this show, if your teacher refuses you the right to use the toilet, tell them all these issues that you're going to face.
And that it is your right.
Exactly.
As determined by the United Nations.
Right. We're going to go for a quick toilet break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the Larry Nassar case. BFM 89.9.
The Health News Digest on the Bigger Picture. BFM 89.9.
Welcome back to the show. It's Health News Digest. I'm Tina Kamila. In the studio with me, Tisha Eek and Juliet Jacobs. We're talking about the things that lurk in the dark, whether it's bedwetting or sleepless children, sleepless parents. Now we're going to talk about our private parts. Yes. This is on the back of the Larry Nassar case in the US, where the medical doctor for the American gymnastics team was sentenced for sexually violating the gymnasts over the course of several decades, I think, two or three decades. Mm-hmm. So now we're revisiting how to talk to kids about who can touch whom and where and when.
I think when we're talking about predators, they don't just look in the dark. They look openly. Mm-hmm. They are very often the people who are supposed to be caring for our kids. Obviously, in many sad, tragic cases, parents themselves are the ones. Teachers, figures of authority, and, you know, Larry Nassar, who is the doctor and supposed to be taking care of these children. So what we need to do is to teach our kids, of the adults within their environment, how can these adults touch them? How are they allowed to touch them?
You know, when this case came to light, one of the things that I hear a lot of parents discuss, you know, if you can't even trust someone in a position of authority, like a doctor, someone who you're supposed to be able to trust your kids with, then what's left for us, right? Who can we trust?
Absolutely.
So I spoke again to Dr. Rajni, consultant developmental pediatrician, Dr. Rajni Savanandhan, on her thoughts on this case.
I think what the Larry Nassar case highlighted to me was two things. We tell children they should blindly trust people in authority. Number two, the children who were reporting it to their parents, they were not heard. And I think we must always listen to children and take them seriously and give them the benefit of the doubt. Children don't lie about these things, okay? Maybe you get the tiny, less than 1% who may, but nobody wants to lie about these things, okay? And I would say in the Larry Nassar case, we didn't reemphasize to the girls that, look, you're going for a medical. Why should someone be examining your vagina? And I always tell parents, before they take children to see the doctor, depending on what the problem is, you need to prepare your child that you're going to see the doctor. So if the child is complaining of being itchy in her private parts or having difficulty passing motion or something like that, you have to prep your child that when you go to the doctor is going to check your private parts today, but he's not going to hurt you and I'm going to be there. And parents should always be there. And if there's any doctor who wants to examine a child without a parent being right next to them, I would say they're violating the code of ethics. And that goes for all children right up to the age of 18 years. Even if it's a young girl and she's only come with her father, I would insist as a parent that a nurse come into the room and there is a chaperone at all times, just to be sure.
Yes, 100% I agree with that. I can imagine myself being that parent that just never lets my poor child leaves her alone, just there watching, constantly supervising, only because I am so scared. Mm-hmm. Like you said, you know, if you can't trust the people who are supposed to, who are, you know, given all the trust in the world, I mean, yeah, what are you supposed to do, right? So, yeah, no, I'm just going to be there. And like even, a hawk.
Absolutely. Even for me, with a boy, I don't think boys are invulnerable to this as well.
Yeah.
If you had stories of football coaches molesting boys for years. So what I'm really interested to know is, then how do we teach our kids to look for the danger signs, to know how to tell us when something has gone wrong?
And I think this is a personal thing because, you know, on this show as well, we've interviewed, you know, activists who have dealt with things like child sexual molestation and rape and things like that. And they always say the first thing to do is to teach your child the correct terms for their private parts. Mm-hmm. So penis, vagina, breasts, you know, not to call it, oh, your nene or whatever.
Cutesy names.
Yeah,
yes.
Or your... Mm-hmm. Kunchang, kunchang. So whatever it is, right? You don't give it stupid names. You call it by its actual name.
Yes,
because,
yes.
But the problem is parents are so, you know, because of the kind of world we live in, they themselves
it's
are so
almost
nervous.
Taboo.
Yeah. Mm. I can imagine people cringing at us saying vagina right now.
Mm-hmm.
My two-year-old knows that her vagina is called a vagina and not something else. And she will tell me, my vagina is itchy loudly in public. But that's fine because she is...
We don't trivialize certain body parts, right?
Yep. No. And, you know, there's always that rule of nobody is allowed to touch that area except, you know, me or, you know, your dad when we're cleaning because, you know, you've pooped or, you know, those sorts of things. So from this age already, I am teaching her because I'm petrified. I'm petrified that somebody, when I'm not hawk-like enough, will take advantage of...
Because one day she's going to go to school.
Oh, yeah,
she's going to be be in the care of other adults.
Exactly.
So,
yeah.
First, we equip our children. Right.
So we're going to leave you with some advice and messages from Dr. Rajini Savarnandhan about how parents can talk to the kids about their body parts and how they can also actually understand, even from such a young age. A lot of the things that she's going to talk about is very similar to what you just mentioned, Juliet.
Okay. Firstly, start talking to your children about their body parts and refer to body parts in appropriate words. It should start in the preschool stage already. It may be just introducing them to body parts. So saying to them things like, oh, that's your vagina. In your vagina, there are two holes. And one hole is where your pee comes out. And the other hole is where it goes up into your uterus. So this has to be done gradually and with visuals as well. If they have a question, you go further on. If they don't, it may be that they're digesting things and that you may need to revisit it a few times. When you start going into school age, you often find that you need to be a little bit more proactive in terms of talking about boys and girls' relationships and the difference between sex and a relationship, because you quite often find now in primary school kids, they start saying things like, so-and-so likes so-and-so. So that's an opportunity to talk about, oh, okay, that's very normal. And you can introduce, or even before that, you should be talking about safe touch. So as a preschooler, you need to start telling them things like, okay, you know, you're a girl, you can only go to a girl's toilet. A boy can only go to a boy's toilet. When it comes to bathing, only same gender if possible, or if mummies need to bathe their sons. Emphasize the fact that, okay, mummy can touch you here because I'm bathing you, but for both genders, which are the places that people can or cannot touch you? So, for example, you would want to say things like, if it's, say, uncle, maybe uncle can give a hug and give you a kiss on the cheek, but uncle cannot touch you anywhere else. So you have to start setting rules and boundaries even as a preschooler. One way of teaching safe touch is using the distribution of swimming suit. Okay, you know where you wear a swimming suit? This is where people cannot touch you. So if your friend wants to touch you, they can touch you on your shoulder or someone can pat you on the back, but they shouldn't be patting you on your bottom. All this has to be re-emphasized as the child's getting older. Maintain open communication, because then you get to answer questions that children come up with. So even with preschoolers, like going to the toilet and someone helping you in the toilet, before I started to work with abused children, I always assumed that you could not teach preschoolers about how people touch them down there until I had my own child. And, you know, I was very paranoid that everybody was going to be abusing my child, having worked with kids like that. And, you know, you can start talking to them about it. Say, for example, when you're bathing your child or when you're just cleaning your child after your child's been to the toilet, and you can start saying things like, oh, okay, mommy's cleaning your front bum, and now I'm cleaning your back bum, or, you know, I'm cleaning your vagina, I'm cleaning your anus, depending on what you use. It's not too hard, right? I'm not hurting you, right? You must remember to tell me if someone hurts you. And the more you talk about that or you emphasize that, and then at least your child knows this is how it should be done. If someone's being rough with me, you know, a five-year-old doesn't know they're being abused when somebody's digitally penetrating them. But they know it's painful, it's uncomfortable. And they might be able to then tell you, you know what, mommy, today in school, so-and-so hurt me when they were cleaning my bum. Then at least you can have a look. If you're not sure, take them to the doctor. Use daily routines to try and teach them what safe touch is and what appropriate touch is as well.
That's all we have this hour on Health News Digest. I'm Tina Camellia.
I'm Tishao Yi.
I'm Julie Jacobs.
We've been talking about the things that lurk in the dark. This is Health News Digest on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.